Hello, I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas About Science.
What happens when you apply the methods of an enterprise to itself? What happens if you study what scientists do as scientifically as you possibly can? What happens if you apply to our most treasured beliefs the methods we use to make those beliefs and to justify them?
Science under its own microscope is our subject today on Ideas. Our guest is Simon Schaffer, an historian of science at Cambridge, and his theme is the unraveling of received ideas about science.
I think there were two standard images of what the sciences are. One image is that scientists are absolutely special people, that they're much more moral and much more virtuous and much, much cleverer, and that they do things nothing like what anybody else does. And on the other hand, there's an equally powerful public image of science, which is that science is organized common sense, that it's just cookery raised to a fairly sophisticated art. Those are the two dominant images of public science in our culture, and neither of them is right.
If science is neither cookery nor angelic virtuosity, then what is it? Well, that's a topic to which we're going to be paying a lot of attention in the coming months on Ideas. Our series is called How to Think About Science. Conceived by David Cayley and developed over several years, it will involve conversations with many of the people who have recast the image of science in our time. The roster of interviewees includes scientists, philosophers, historians, sociologists, and a poet. Today, David Cayley talks to Simon Schaffer.
In 1985, a book appeared that brilliantly summed up a new approach to the history of science, one that had gradually been taking shape since the 1960s. Until that time, the history of science had usually meant biographies of scientists or studies of the social contexts in which scientific discoveries were made. Scientific ideas were discussed, but the procedures and axioms of science itself were not in question. Leviathan and the Air Pump, the book of which I'm speaking, involved a more searching interrogation. Subtitled Hobbes, Boyle, and the Experimental Life, the book's avowed purpose was, I'm quoting from the introduction, to break down the aura of self-evidence surrounding the experimental way of producing knowledge. This was a work, in other words, that wanted to treat something obvious and taken for granted, that matters of fact are ascertained by experiment, as if it were not at all obvious, that wanted to ask, how is it actually done? And how do people come to agree that it truly has been done? The authors of this path-breaking book were two young historians, Stephen Chapin and Simon Schaffer, and both have gone on to distinguished careers in the field they helped to define, science studies. You'll be hearing from Stephen Chapin later in the series, but how to think about science begins with a conversation with Simon Schaffer. I called on him recently in his office at the Whipple Museum of the History of Science at Cambridge, where he teaches. We talked first about why science came under a new kind of scrutiny during the period when he was just beginning his studies, the 1970s. This was a time, he said, when many modern certainties were shaken, and there was no greater modern certainty than the authority of science. In this atmosphere, a new generation of scholars began to ask new questions. No longer content just to take scientists at their word, they wanted to see for themselves how science is made.
Our impression was that we hadn't engaged closely enough with the really lived work scientists and technologists actually do. We'd relied almost entirely on what they said. We hadn't been to look. So significant groups of social scientists, mainly in Britain, interestingly, began to work in labs alongside scientists, in field stations, in research clinics, in zoos and botanic gardens, to follow the scientists around, to try and look at what they did. We were using field methods, in other words, borrowed entirely from the field sciences, except this time, instead of looking at lemurs, we were looking at physicists. Instead of looking at Trobriand Islanders, we were looking at Californians.
These observations yielded a picture of science that varied dramatically from the image that philosophers of science had put forward. Science, according to these philosophers, was essentially reason in action. Simon Schaffer and his colleagues came to a very different conclusion.
It seemed that we were dealing with groups of very skilled craftspeople, people who were ingenious and clever and skillful, who had lots of what we called tacit knowledge, who were very well trained, who were more like engineers than they were like priests. They didn't have very much bigger brains. Their skulls look very similar to other people. They didn't seem to be doing anything terribly special in terms of methods. They didn't seem to be much more skeptical than the rest of us. They didn't seem to be constantly making bold conjectures and then desperately trying to falsify them. They seemed to be the ingenious manipulators and managers and artisans of carefully designed workspaces, whether in labs or in the field. And we wanted, I think, to say that that was how it was.
Scientists, in the eyes of Simon Schaffer and his colleagues, began to look less like oracles and more like skilled carpenters. Their knowledge was not the very voice of nature, but a human product, something that had to be made and then maintained. And this insight turned the received view of the relationship between science and society upside down. Formerly, science had been seen as social only when it was wrong. Social interests distorted and corrupted knowledge. True knowledge was immaculate, untouched by human hands. Now, Schaffer says, the sciences began to be understood as inherently social.
Knowledge is an institution, and it should be analyzed as such. That what people say about the world in groups, and how they come to agree, and how they find out how things are, has the quality of an institution, and it should be analyzed the way other institutions are analyzed. That meant, for example, that it was extremely unpromising, to put it mildly, to suppose that social principles are only acting when folk get things wrong. So, for example, it didn't look remotely plausible to say that Isaac Newton thought that there was an inverse square law of gravity acting instantly at a distance through empty space between the centers of distant bodies because there is an inverse square law acting instantly from the center of one body to another through empty space. And Leibniz disagreed because he was German. That's to explain the truth one way, that's to say to explain what we think is so one way, and to explain what we don't think is so a completely different way, as though there are these things called social forces which wreck our ability to see how things are. What we learnt was that there are social institutions at work to produce what we know, and indeed to produce what anybody claims to know at any particular period. It seemed just very odd that only if you escape from society can you see how things really are? That didn't seem right to us. It seemed to us, and it still seems to me, that people in social groups build their knowledge like they build other institutions, and you should analyze how they do that the way you analyze the institutions people build. That means that we were trying to think as hard as we possibly could about how people come together to build the institutions by which they live. And some of the most important institutions by which they live are the things they hold to be true about the world. That meant, therefore, that it would be a great idea, a really, really good idea, to look at controversies, both in the present and in the past. Look at controversies in the present, where you don't know what the right answer is yet. Then you'd be looking at rival groups trying to make the knowledge claims that they were concerned with into institutions that everyone could join. If you didn't yet know what the right answer is, they didn't even know what the right answer was. If you could follow what was called science in action, you could follow a controversy around, you could see how people come to believe what they believe and know what they know. To use a phrase from, I think, one of the most important sociologists of scientific knowledge, Harry Collins, you could see how the ship gets in the bottle. Once it's in the bottle, you can't imagine how it got there. You can't see the little hinges in the mast. You can't imagine the tweezers and the glue. It just looks as though it's always been there. But what we wanted to do was to see how ships get put into bottles. And as they're being put into bottles, they look messy and complicated and contingent and possibly chaotic, and maybe they won't fit. Maybe it'll all fall to bits, and some different vessel will end up in some different container. We wanted to do this not only as it was happening now, so my colleagues in Bath and Edinburgh and Paris and elsewhere were studying fights in neuroscience and biochemistry and astrophysics and nuclear technology. We also wanted to look at these episodes in the past as well, where the job, we thought, might be even harder. And the reason the job might be even harder is because we know the end of the story. We know what's going to happen in the end. Okay, imagine that you don't. Imagine that you go back 300 years and you don't know who's going to win. You don't know what the right answer is yet. Can you follow through a fight in the past, imagining that you can't really tell who has right on their side, and then try to unfold the process by which what's the case about the world was established and institutionalized? That's what we set out to do.
Simon Schaffer has undertaken a number of studies in which historical controversies are used as a window through which one can observe science in the making, the ship as it's being put into the bottle. The most famous of these is the book I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Leviathan and the Air Pump, to which we now turn. Co-written with Stephen Shapin, it concerned Robert Boyle, the most noted English experimentalist of the 17th century, and his contemporary, Thomas Hobbes, who disputed Boyle's claim that experiment is the most certain road to knowledge. Here, in outline, is the story.
Once upon a time, there was a very wealthy Irishman called Robert Boyle, who was born into great wealth and great social prestige in the 1620s. Who is known as the son of the Earl of Cork and the father of modern chemistry. By the 1650s, 1660s, in a time of political crisis and cultural revolution in Britain. He'd established himself first in the city of Oxford, and then, after the restoration of King Charles II in London, very fashionable part of town, as really one of the masters of a new kind of project. Experimental philosophy is what he called it, which would involve using elegant and complicated machinery to find out how nature worked by performing experiments. And these experiments mobilized a whole new series of techniques, which now seem, or might seem to us, to be absolutely obvious. But they're new in that period, and so they had to be explained and defended. The kinds of techniques that he used was, first of all, to design and commission complicated engines and machines. And the most complicated and the most prestigious was an air pump. The reason he was interested in the air was because one of his heroes, the great royal physician, William Harvey, had demonstrated that the blood circulates in humans and animals and that it passes through the surface of the lungs. And something, William Harvey says, enters the blood from the outside world through our lungs. And the question is, what? Why does the blood circulate? That was the chief research question of Harvey's followers and therefore of Robert Boyle. Now, Boyle's genius, you might say, and again, this has become absolutely self-evident for scientists now, is if you want to know about the properties of something, it's a really good idea to get rid of it and then see what difference that makes. So, obviously, in Boyle's world, it would have been a good idea to do experiments on the moon where there's no air, but they couldn't get to the moon, so they built an air pump instead and put animals inside this machine to see what happened to them if they didn't have air. That was the research agenda. Now, the reason that's a new kind of approach is, to go very quickly, is because what Boyle was after here was mixing up two categories, which up till then had been radically different. The category of nature and of art, or engineering, as we might say. Roughly before the 1600s, natural philosophy, the knowledge of nature, was understood as being knowing how nature normally behaves, how it commonly is. So, for example, we know that bodies made of earth fall on straight lines towards the center of the earth because that's what they normally do. We know that bodies composed of fire mainly move on straight lines away from the center of the earth because that's what they normally do. What men like Boyle were arguing was no. The way to find out how things are is to produce singular, odd, strange, mechanically produced instances. Stop observing nature as it normally is. Start producing effects which you can isolate and analyze. That's a huge shift in how to find out about nature. But in order to do that, you needed other techniques as well. And in our book, we focus on two of those. One was the way in which Boyle organized other people. He brought together, as it were, in the room where these experiments were being done, witnesses. People who would agree that what Boyle said was going on was going on. And then when Boyle printed an account of what he said was going on, they would sign up to it. And the activity of witnessing became very, very important for the new science because it meant that knowledge was collective. A group of people stood committed to a particular claim. And one starts to see the way in which, in order for experiments to work, they have to become socialized. They have to be communal. They have to be a kind of group activity. That was the argument. And then finally, how do you describe them when you write down the account and then print it and then distribute it? And we were very struck by the way in which Robert Boyle in particular writes so that when you read his stories, It's as if you're watching what he's seeing. And we called that virtual witnessing, this new kind of writing which brought you to presence, which allowed you to imagine you were a witness too. And since witnessing an experiment was so important, but you couldn't bring everybody into the room, this kind of what we called literary technique was a way of multiplying the number of people who could be imagined as taking part in making the fact. So we had working with a machine, bringing people together to see the machine working, and then writing down what it was that you saw so that your readers were, at least in imagination, also present. And if all that was in place, you produced what Boyle called a matter of fact, something which was so authoritative and so plausible that you couldn't deny that it had happened. And then finally, an invitation to repeat what Boyle had done. You were invited, though it was expensive and difficult and complex, to build your own pump and check what he'd done.
Why, at that time, in that place, did it become so important to produce a matter of fact?
Well, there's a question which I think citizens in the early 21st century will be very familiar with, which is in a time of war and global struggle, when it's extremely hard to know what's really happening in the world, and when rival powers claim different people's allegiances, and when there's a huge clash of ideologies between states, between religions, between different groups of people, when hundreds and thousands of people are being killed for their beliefs, and when one doesn't know where to look for secure, well-grounded authority. Any group of people who come along and say, look, we have a method, we have an approach, we have a program which will give you undeniable truths on the basis of which you can then reason without fighting and you can come to agreement through negotiation. That group of people is offering a solution to a major social problem. It's still a social problem for us. We still live, in fact, we intensely live, in a world dominated by a crisis of trust. We aren't sure which experts to believe. Perhaps it's because there are too many experts. Perhaps it's because there aren't enough. That's the situation in the middle of the 1600s in Britain, and indeed in most of Western Europe. This is an epoch of crisis, of war, of religious and political conflict. And Robert Boyle and his friends make that point explicit. So the argument is that we live in an age in which men use the sword rather than reason to come to agreement, in which there's violent dispute. We need a way, we need a whole enterprise which will produce undeniable truths and then allow people to see how to argue without killing each other. And the experimental philosophy explicitly offered itself as a recipe, not just for producing truth, but for displaying how to argue without violence or catastrophe. So the solution to the problem of knowledge, which Robert Boyle and his friends offered, which is how do you get people to agree, becomes a solution to the problem of social order. How do you get citizens to behave? How do you get a social group to come together, argue, negotiate, agree, and dispute? The way in which experimental philosophy became exemplary is always also a political as well as a scientific achievement. And they say so.
Trust, establishing his credibility, as we would say, was a very important matter for Robert Boyle. And Stephen Chapin and Simon Schaffer's study of how Boyle gained assent is one of the most original aspects of their book. Very often, it is skepticism, or a disbelieving attitude, that is treated as the hallmark of science. The motto of the Royal Society, of which Robert Boyle was a founding member, was Nullius in Verba, on no man's word. John Locke, Boyle's contemporary and associate, says, For example, I'm quoting verbatim, "In the sciences, everyone has only so much as he really knows. What he believes only and takes upon trust are but shreds." But Simon Schaffer argues that the really critical achievement of science lies not in its skepticism, but in its ability to create and maintain trust.
The basic question which collective public knowledge always has to solve in every culture is, who should I believe and why? Almost everything everyone knows about the world, they know on trust. Almost all our knowledge is testimony. Very little of what we believe and know about the world is based entirely and absolutely on our own experience. And the social order requires that kind of mutual trust. Now, one of the models that we've inherited in our world is empiricism. Empiricism is the philosophical position that my knowledge comes from what I experience. And there's a problem there, because most of what I know and believe, I haven't directly experienced. I've experienced through others. I've experienced not immediately, but mediately. Adam Smith, a great Scottish economist of the 18th century, puts this wonderfully in one of his lectures. He says, if you reckon up what you know about the world, you'll see that most of what you know has been purchased, like your shoes and socks, from those whose business it is to put these goods on the market. Right? And I think that's still absolutely true. If I reflect about what I know about the world, what I think is true, almost all of it is based on what I've heard or been told or read, not what I've directly experienced. And I think a useful slogan is, the Western natural sciences work very well, partly because they organize trust extremely efficiently, not because they organize skepticism and doubt extremely efficiently. We tend to think, perhaps, that scientists are the people who don't believe anything, who question everything, who don't rely on anybody else's belief, who only believe what they see with their eyes and feel with their fingers. And to a certain extent, there's something in that. But by and large, if one visits and works in a laboratory or an observatory or a botanic garden or a hospital or a zoo, you quickly realize that no, actually, the really impressive aspect of the natural sciences in our culture is that they seem to be very good at knowing who to believe, who else to believe, who else to trust. They have these extraordinarily long-range networks which distribute trust and authority relatively efficiently. If you look round a working laboratory, likely it'll be full of machinery and equipment not made by the people working in the lab. They have to rely on the people who've made those devices or made those observations or calibrated the contents of those bottles or design that piece of software. So a laboratory is a place connected through immensely complicated networks to the labours of many, many other people. And if those people's work can be trusted, then what goes on in that lab can be trusted. And the network of science and technology is a very good system, so it seems, for getting it right about testimony and trust.
Only a handful of people actually witnessed Robert Boyle's experiments in the air pump. Even fewer ever tried to repeat them. Some who did got different results. And this was one of the reasons why Thomas Hobbes was not impressed by Robert Boyle's claim that experimental science was the royal road to civility and social peace. Hobbes thought that the proper model of knowledge was geometry, with its carefully defined axioms and demonstrable proofs. The air pump, he said, was of the nature of a pop gun, something which children use, though, he allowed, more costly and more ingenious. Such a toy could not provide demonstrable knowledge. Its operation was too unreliable, its operators too potentially self-interested. It was an argument history had forgotten, but which Stephen Chapin and Simon Schaffer took very seriously.
We were very excited and fascinated by the dispute which broke out in 1660-1661 between Hobbes and Boyle, because it seemed to raise a lot of the questions we were also interested in. Hobbes had a very deep objection to the kind of claims the experimenters were making. And his principal objection was that they were exaggerating the security of their operation. They said, he thought, if you get a group of people together and you show them a singular phenomenon, some experiment or other, then they will come to agree and they will never dispute about the result they've seen. And Hobbes thought that was incredible. That's to say, he didn't believe that. He did not believe that if you get a group of people together and what they're looking at really matters, that they will effortlessly agree about what's going on in the world. His experience, he was in 1660, 72 years old. So in his 70s, he could think back over a life in Britain and elsewhere, which showed him that if folk's interests clash, they will clash. And you need much more powerful methods for bringing people to agree and behave and obey than simply showing them a machine or a phenomenon and then hoping that because they've all seen the same thing, they'll all say the same thing. So Hobbes simply didn't believe the ambitious claims experimenters were making. He couldn't see why, if these are issues of major concern to people, suddenly they'd all give up their interests and their passions and all say, yep, you're right, that's how it is. You're right, we're wrong, and we all agree, and peace is broken out. Hobbes was, you might say, more pessimistic, you might say more realistic about human nature. Right? He didn't foresee, could not foresee, a world in which people would come to an easy agreement because they'd just been shown something. That was one major argument. Second kind of argument that Hobbes had was that just because this happens in one place, how do we know it happens elsewhere? You claim that what happens in the back of your house in Pall Mall in London, there can be empty space in the world. Or you claim that because you've seen a stone fall in a chamber, that therefore all stones fall like that everywhere. How do we know that? Show me. Show me it happening everywhere. Show me it happening always. You can't do that. You can't build a knowledge of the universe from what you see on one occasion.
So there's no such thing as experimental philosophy in Hobbes.
In that
sense,
there can't be such a thing.
There
can't be such a thing. Unless
it's not philosophy.
Yes, it isn't philosophy. Unless you've already, and it's Hobbes' favourite word, reckoned. Unless you've already reckoned on what you know and what must be the case about the world, simply seeing what happens on one occasion at one time, in one place, is not enough. It's not how you build up universal knowledge. What you have to do is to analyze and reason. Hobbes is the rationalist in that sense, in this fight. Hobbes admired the power of human reason. He admired the way in which we were able to reckon up what we know, what must be the case about the world, rather than building up this, as he would have seen it, a house of cards from this special privileged instance. And those two criticisms fit together. His first criticism is experiment cannot compel people to agree, and people won't agree unless they're forced. And his second criticism is, how do I know simply by looking at an experiment that it will always be thus? If you can't show me that it will always be thus. I don't have to agree with you. And if I don't have to agree with you, probably I won't agree with you. So it was politically dangerous, Hobbes finally argues, to offer a recipe to produce peace if you know the recipe won't work. And these were powerful criticisms and needed answers. And they elicited from Boyle and his allies answers which are very, very interesting because they had to spell out more and more of what they were assuming about the world and of the basis of the claims that they were making. They had to spell out their views of social order. They had to spell out their views of religion. They had to spell out how they thought these techniques of agreement and trust were supposed to work. And Hobbes, who was possibly the most irascible human being of the 17th century, went on fighting for the rest of his life, more or less. What's interesting in the end is that that fight then, to a large extent, was forgotten. Forgotten not only by historians of the sciences, but also, more interestingly, ignored in very interesting ways by people who were fascinated by Hobbes. Because it was embarrassing, perhaps, that this great rationalist, the chief theoretician of modernity, which Hobbes is in many ways, secular, rational, progressive, modern, a brilliant analyst of politics and of philosophy, was on this occasion, so it seemed, on the wrong side. Why? Because he was fighting the experimenters. He was fighting men like Robert Boyle, and that's not nice. So one of the things I think we set out to do was to go back to a fight which was in a way, I don't want to exaggerate this, but was in a way hidden from history, and bring it back to light, to take what was at stake seriously. And if you take the critics of experiment remotely seriously, that's a high-risk strategy, because it might look as though you're on their side, where what one's trying to do is to bring up for analysis the assumptions that people make when they make claims about how we should find out what there is in the world.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. The program is called How to Think About Science, and it's presented by David Cayley.
Leviathan and the Air Pump was a controversial book. It was widely read outside the new field of science studies, and is probably still the most frequently cited text that the field has produced, but it also attracted the charge of being anti-science. Simon Schaffer thinks that this was the result of the point of view he and Stephen Chapin adopted. They wrote, in a sense, as anthropologists, distancing themselves from taken-for-granted assumptions about science, trying to get a fresh look at things usually taken as too obvious even to question.
I think we were accused of being subversive and anti-scientific because, no doubt, the kinds of stories that we wanted to tell and the kinds of questions we wanted to ask seemed unfamiliar or troublesome for certain kinds of images of what the sciences are. And I think there were two standard images which were in trouble as a result of what we seem to be saying. One image, which is very important in the past of the sciences, is that scientists are absolutely special people, that they're absolutely different from the rest of us, that they do things nothing like what anybody else does, that they're much more moral and much more virtuous and much, much cleverer and altogether a kind of different group of persons. That was a very important theme in the long history of public science, and lots of people have said that. And we were saying, no, actually, from that point of view, the people in the past and the people in the present whom we're trying to understand don't seem to be morally or ethically or cerebrally different from the rest of us. On the other hand, there's an equally powerful public image of science, an image which is subscribed to by many great scientists of the past and the present, which is that science is organized common sense. There's nothing special going on in the sciences. It's what everybody does all the time. That it's just cookery raised to a fairly sophisticated art. And that's equally been a way of defending the value of science. Right? Those two images, they're absolutely different from us. All they're doing is what we do. Those are the two dominant images of public science in our culture, and neither of them is right. They both have enormous problems associated with them. If you make the scientists into some kind of clerisy, some kind of priesthood, this has extremely bad effects on politics and knowledge and culture. And also, it seems to me, an entirely inaccurate way of understanding what scientists do. If, on the other hand, you say that they're not doing anything different, they're not doing anything special, there isn't a special family of techniques, nothing terribly different goes on in laboratories and clinics, you just don't understand what does go on there. Why these are complicated, specially organized institutions. So between those two extremes, we wanted a third way. And the friends of the two extremes attacked us with, I have to say, rudeness, violence, inaccuracy, misquotation, and the threat of unemployment in several cases. And it was a very unpleasant period indeed. Several of my friends either lost their jobs or were threatened with losing their jobs on the grounds that they were the enemies of the sciences. And it was a very unhappy period.
This period, roughly from the late 1980s to the late 1990s, became known as the Science Wars. Historians like Simon Schaffer were accused of constructivism, that is, of portraying scientific knowledge as no more than a vulnerable human construction. But why, Simon Schaffer wonders, should scientific discoveries be thought less true or less noble just because they are seen to have been made by human hands?
By showing exactly how the institutions of our society come into being and how they work and why they're so effective, we were accused of making them ineffective.
By taking the mystery out of them.
Perhaps. Certainly, my friend David Bloor would say that what was going on in that stupid debate recapitulated a debate which happened at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century between people who were literalist about the Bible and people who wanted to write its history. People who pointed out that the Bible had been written by human beings, that the texts of scripture should be analysed in the same way as other texts, were accused by their enemies of atheism, of denying the truths of scripture, of subverting the institutions of the Christian religion. And there is some very interesting similarities between that fight, mainly in the German lands around 1800, and these fights, mainly taking place in New Jersey and Wisconsin in the 1980s and 1990s. And I think that's a very interesting analogy. Demystification is often treated as catastrophic undermining.
The Science Wars was a name that lumped together a variety of happenings. A few academic blacklistings, a handful of polemical books, a lot of caricature. Like the guests of the legendary Procrustes, who boasted of an unusual bed into which anyone could fit, but achieved the feat by violently lengthening or shortening the guest, people seeking a revised understanding of science were chopped or stretched to fit the narrow bed of anti-science. Simon Schaffer views it in retrospect as a panic in which the purging of certain outworn myths was taken as something far more threatening. Today, the controversy seems to have died, or at least been superseded. One reason might be broad changes in the sciences themselves, changes that can hardly be attributed to the work of a few controversial scholars. In fact, the very idea of what a science is has changed dramatically in his lifetime, Simon Schaffer says.
When I was a student, the model science was theoretical physics. That was the pattern science. All other sciences aspired to the status of theoretical physics. And when you learn, say, the philosophy of the sciences, the examples were taken from theoretical physics, from Newton, from Maxwell, from Einstein. Right? And that meant that when you were writing about the sciences, you had in your mind the idea of what an abstract mathematical physicist does as the pattern you were trying to explain. Complicated mathematical hypotheses make predictions which are tested out in experiments, in controlled conditions, in carefully designed laboratories. That was the image of the sciences that we had. And all other sciences were kind of imperfect versions of that. That was what we were told. I think over the last 30 to 40 years, our image of what we're trying to explain and what the sciences are like has completely changed. And one way of understanding how it's changed is that for us now, the pattern science is something like agronomy or field botany. In other words, we've switched from thinking of the pattern science as theoretical physics to thinking of the pattern science as a field science. The sciences which involve immense amounts of travel, constructing field stations in the wild, and involve moving people around from place to place. So what that means is that ecology and agronomy, I think, are now the pattern sciences. The plant trials that people do to see if genetically modified organisms work in one place or in another, are they safe here or there? The field trials people do on new forms of transportation, that's more like what the sciences are. Now, if that's true, you'll start asking completely different questions. One change is that instead of asking who came first, which is the traditional question for the historian of science, was it really Isaac Newton who was the first to describe universal gravitation? Was it really Albert Einstein who was the first to formulate the principle of special relativity? Rather, instead of those questions of time order, you'll ask questions about space order. I see this failed technique works here. How does it get to work there? I see that these plants grow here. How did they ever get to grow there? How do drugs get tried and moved around? How do clinical trials work? Those are the questions that historians and sociologists of science, I think, are much more possessed by, in a way. And not only do they, as it were, switch from chronology to geography, yeah, from who came first to how does it get to work over there, but they also, therefore, are much more interested in why people agree than why they disagree.
New questions have produced a new image of science as an extensive and effective social institution. And this more realistic, less mythological portrait of the sciences needs to be conveyed to the public, Simon Schaffer argues. So when science, with a capital S, pronounces, he says finally, citizens will have some idea of how such pronouncements actually take shape.
Good way of thinking about it is to think a little harder about the phrase public understanding of science, which is a phrase that at least in Britain, I don't know about the Canadian situation, unfortunately, but in Britain, this was a phrase that was developed mainly in the mid-80s, when it was perceived that insufficiently large numbers of people were entering the sciences as a career, which I think sadly is absolutely the case, and in which opinion pollsters could very easily find vast numbers of people on the streets of London who thought that atoms were smaller than electrons, or that the Earth goes around the moon, or something like that. And that seemed disturbing and worrying, which it is. So a movement for the public understanding of science started. But the phrase public understanding of science is intrinsically ambiguous. It might mean how many people understand the view of the world that science gives us. It might mean how many people understand how scientists produce a view of the world. And there's a slippage between those two senses of public understanding of science. I still remain absolutely convinced that without one, you can't have the other. You've got to make sure that people have a very good understanding of how scientists achieve an understanding of the world, and through that, you can get people to understand the view of the world that sciences produce, what its worth, its status, and its contents. And without that, you don't have citizens. You don't have intelligent citizens who can take part fully in the debates that really matter, whether that's about nuclear disarmament or global warming. You similarly don't have a clear model of how to distribute trust in our society. And I think that's one of the most important issues in our world today around the sciences. That it's not that we don't trust anybody, it's that we don't know who to trust. We're surrounded by experts. We have experts who tell us how to eat and how to drink. We have experts who tell us how to get married and when. We have experts who tell us how to invest and how not to invest. The world, both in North America and in Europe, is stock full of expertise. This is not a period when there's been a crisis of expertise or a loss of deference. On the contrary, you could argue that people defer to unprecedentedly large numbers of experts. I didn't even know until a few years ago that I was supposed to ask advice about how to organise a wedding or how to educate my children. And now, of course, one does. So if we had better, more accurate, more effective models of how expertise and trust work in our culture, and above all, how trust and expertise are distributed with the sciences and with technology, I think this would be a crucially progressive move in our politics as well.
Simon, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Historian Simon Schaffer, recorded in his office at the Whipple Museum of the History of Science at Cambridge. How to Think About Science will continue next week at this time with a conversation with Lorraine Dastan, the director of the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in Berlin. She'll talk about her new book on the history of objectivity.
On Ideas, you've listened to How to Think About Science, produced and presented by David Cayley, with the assistance of Dave Field, Liz Nagy, and Bernie Lucht. The entire 24-hour series is available as a printed transcript. You can also buy audio copies, download the podcast, or listen again on our website. Find out more at cbc.ca/ideas. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.